Craig James' search for old photos of slaves took him closer to his own history than he could ever have imagined. His sister told him about a cousin, and that cousin told him about a photo, and the photo apparently existed at an old farm not far from where Craig James' family home was in North Carolina. Where, he asked. The old James plantation, he was told. So Craig went in search of not just this one photo, but a chance to set foot on that plantation, where his ancestors worked, the plantation that gave him his own last name.
But once I walked on the grounds and I looked around and I saw all of these things, and I imagined my ancestors being there. There was a sense of connection made and could sense what it may have been like.
Craig James talks about what he sees of himself in a photo taken years before he was born. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Craig James didn't start out to be an amateur historian. He's a lawyer. But a friend got him interested in old photos. Tintypes and daguerreotypes of African Americans. These were among the first commercially available kinds of photographs that started being made back in the mid-1800s. The images are usually portraits because the people would have to sit still for a long time while the exposure was made. Craig James is intrigued by the science but captivated by the faces. There are no names. There's no way to know who the people are in most cases. So Craig looks at one photo of a nanny, an African-American woman holding a small white child, and he lets his imagination go.
No, I'm not her mother, and from my womb she did not come. But it was I who rocked her, and it was in my bosom she found rest. My voice was authority, and my presence recognized. My hands guided, soothed, trained. And yes, she loved me.
That's Craig James with his short poem called Mammy, one that he wrote about a photograph in his collection. I asked Craig why he started collecting, what he sees in these images.
What I was seeing was these African-American people in these photographs who were portraying the life of the time. These photographs had captured the actual time of these African-Americans as they lived. And they were real photographs. They're not just drawings or depictions of someone else's opinion or someone else's mindset, but they were the actual photographs.
Tell me what you were looking at. What's in the photograph?
A man who may have looked somewhat ragged, but then again, there were these photographs of individuals who were well-dressed and very distinguished-looking, even though their faces told a somewhat different story. You know, there was no smiles, and there was seemed to be no happiness or joy in their face.
Why do you suppose the photographs, because these would have been taken from the mid-1800s, right? Some of the early ones?
That is correct.
Why do you suppose they were taken?
During that time period, it was a status symbol when you were able to photograph your slaves and your Negro people.
Do you ever find out what happened to these photographs when they were taken? I can't imagine a slave owner putting the pictures of his workers up on the wall, nor can I imagine him giving them to the workers, you know?
I believe they sat right on the mantle among his other photographs so that when other people would visit, they would see these photographs. And in their minds, they began to think, wow, he must be doing pretty good because he can photograph not just his family, but also he can photograph his slaves and the people that work for him.
Wow. So it's a kind of showing off.
Yeah. It was a kind of showing off.
Like someone might have a picture of a car or some possession up on the...
Right.
Is there any one photograph that really drew you in, that made you think, I'm going to spend some time studying this whole art or craft of photographing people from so long ago, particularly African Americans?
The photograph is an African American boy and a white boy. The African-American boy is standing next to the white boy who is seated, and he has his arm around the white boy's shoulders.
Like friends?
Like friends. That photograph spoke so much to me because, number one, here are two boys who probably never thinks of race, but one day they will grow up and be adults. And it's very likely that the white child will be taught that he's better or that he's superior to the black boy, and based upon conditions of life and circumstances, their friendship probably will be strained, and he will have to go in a different direction than this little African-American boy.
Any way, Craig, of guessing how old these boys are looking at the photo?
They appear to be about 10 or 11 years of age.
And what do you see in their faces?
On the black boy's face, what you see is this expression of, I can't believe I'm being photographed. On the white boy's face, he has a posture as if I deserve to be photographed.
He's sitting down, right?
Right.
He's the one sitting down.
So you can clearly see that he is the subject of the photography. The black boy is more of a prop. He is simply there, whereas it is the white kid that is actually being photographed.
And in this photograph, is there a background that tells any part of a story?
The background is plain.
Like a studio of
yes,
some sort, right?
Correct.
Or hung a blanket behind the kids or something?
Correct.
And when you look through a bunch of photographs and you grab one like this,
uh-huh,
what does it mean to you?
It means that history is being validated. If someone was to say to you that back during slavery there were mammies and there were a charge where a young black person was assigned to a young white person to care for them and to do whatever they told them to do, and in your imagination you try to picture that, but then you get an actual photograph where you see this mammy holding the white child in her lap. It's an authentic, original photograph. It validates the history. Did that really exist? Yes, this photograph proves it. And as long as the photograph exists, I see a validation of history. I have one photograph where the African American is not allowed to look into the camera. So as the photograph is being taken, the white person who is the subject of the photograph is looking into the camera. But the African American is looking off to the side because they are really just a prop. They are there to hold the child, to make sure the child doesn't move. So you can see the subservient posture in that.
Actually, there's a sort of practical side of it too, isn't it? That when these old photographs were being taken, people had to hold still for a long time. Maybe there's something to the idea that if you wanted a picture of your baby at peace, the child was more likely to be at peace with the woman who cared for the baby. And if that woman was a black nanny, then she'd be in the photo, right?
That is correct. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly correct.
Your eyes must always be drawn to the faces, though.
Always drawn to the faces. Because the faces speak a multitude of words to you. And you begin to wonder, what are they really trying to say? What are they really saying? You know, their faces speak out of their experience. And based on the experiences that they are encountering, their faces have different looks and it's at different depths. It's one of the rarest ones that I own is a elderly black lady and she's smiling. It's the only one I have. She's in her Sunday best. She's in a very nice hat. It's a tintype photograph, and she smiles. And you have to ask yourself, what was it about her life that at the moment she got photographed, she smiles?
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Craig James will likely never know the answer to questions like that one. One day, the exercise of collecting photos and imagining stories from the past became personal.
My sister gave me a phone call. She was visiting an elderly relative, and the elderly relative informed her that there was a photograph that existed of my great-great-great-grandmother, and that another cousin may have had the photograph. And she gave me that cousin's name, and I immediately called that cousin, and I inquired about this photograph. And she informed me, yes, I have a copy of the photograph. But she went on to tell me that the original photograph still existed, and it was at the plantation. And so I go, excuse me, at the plantation? What exactly do you mean, at the plantation? And she says, well, you know the old James plantation still exists. I said, what, still exists? Still exists where? She says, still exists right outside, you know, right here in Maple Hill, North Carolina, where I grew up.
The plantation where your ancestors had worked?
at the plantation where my ancestors had worked. And she said, I talked to the great-granddaughter. She still lives on the plantation. I talk to her periodically. She said, I can call her and we can go visit her if you would like. I said, absolutely. Please call her.
At this point, you have been collecting these photographs of unknown people, right?
Yes.
And you're about to see a photograph of your great-great-great-grandmother.
Correct.
What's going through your mind?
Well, she also tells me that my great-great-great-grandmother is holding the great-granddaughter of the slave owner. And when she says that, I'm thinking, this can't be real. I own pictures of nannies and mammies and charges with white kids. This can't be real that my actual great-great-great-grandmother, who was born a slave, there's a photograph of her in existence. I said, I have to see it. I have to see the photograph. And in my mind, I was thinking, I have to own it.
So Craig James and his sister make the appointment. Craig sets off for the old James plantation.
On the drive there, I have mixed emotions. I'm thinking, you know, my ancestors were here. I'm getting ready to go to the very ground where they walked, where they labored, where they may have been abused, where they were owned as animal or as chattel or however you want to say it. You know, they were property. They were someone's property. And I'm getting ready to meet the direct descendant of the man who owned them. All of these thoughts are running through my mind, you know, about my ancestors and how life must have been for them.
In just a moment, we'll hear what happened when Craig made it to the very place where his great-great-great-grandmother was photographed. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Craig James collects old photographs of African Americans, photos that were taken, some in the mid-1800s, around the time when slavery was supposed to be abolished. Craig studies the faces in the photos and writes about what he imagines might have been going on at the time.
I see this elderly gentleman who is well-dressed. He has on what appears to be a three-piece suit, a bow tie. He even has a chain, a watch or some type of locket at the end. And the words that came to mind was, the years have passed me by, but the days are yet with me. From sun up to sundown, it's forever etched in my spirit. I should be bitter, filled with hatred and malice. I did nothing wrong, but still I had many years.
Do you see a pride in that man's face?
I see a pride in that man's face that through all of the circumstances, through all of the hard work, he has yet endured. He's holding the lapel of his jacket as if to say, I'm still here. I made it, you know.
It's like the Jesse Jackson, I am somebody, right?
Yes, I am somebody. And even though he's aged, he's yet proud.
I can see your imagination just getting lost in these photos.
Yeah, it does sometimes. It does.
Craig James' pursuit of these old photos took him in a completely new direction when he found out that a photograph of his own ancestor, a great-great-great-grandmother, was still in a book at the old home that was part of the plantation where this ancestor had been kept as a slave. Craig quickly made his way there, to the land near Maple Hill, North Carolina, to see that image.
And we pull up to the Sycamore Springs Plantation, which in my community has always been called the Old James Plantation. And just like you see it on TV, here's this long drive, has these large dogwood trees on both sides of the drive. And at the very end, you can see the big house sitting
there. It's
like
a scene from Gone with the Wind, right?
Yeah, like a scene from Gone with the Wind. We drive down this long pathway, and Miriam James, and her brother Richard James are both there standing on the porch.
Now, they're your age, this generation, or they're a generation older?
Well, they're probably between 75 and 80 years
old. Oh, okay, so they're at least one generation ahead of you, right?
At least one generation ahead of me. So they're both standing there, and, you know, we get out of the car, and they welcome us. And we go into the house, you know, just began to talk. I introduce myself as to who I am.
Things a little stiff here, or?
Well, no, it's not stiff at all, because Miriam comes across as a very sweet lady, and she's just, you know, happy to see us, that we would even consider coming by to visit and to see the place.
It is shared history, as good or bad or ugly, whatever. It is shared history, right?
Absolutely.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Miriam James, a descendant of the slave-owning family, took Craig James, a descendant of the slaves, on a tour of what had been the plantation. Craig's imagination is alive with everything he sees.
Wow, did my ancestors ride on those wagons? What were they hauling in those wagons? You know, and I'm just, are these slave quarters or are they just buildings that they worked in?
How much was Miriam able to tell you about what she knew in terms of the way the plantation had been set up and where people had lived and what they'd done?
She was able to point out where the slave quarters were. She was able to say who built this building. Some of them had names on them and the dates dating back to like 1820. It was amazing to me that this place existed, and it exists about 3 or 4 miles from where my parents currently live. You know, where I grew up, it's right there. And
well, it's almost as if people didn't want to tell you that it had been there, you know
right,
what I mean? Part of that forgetting instead of the remembering.
Exactly. And but once I walked on the grounds and I looked around and I saw all of these things, and I imagined my ancestors being there. There was this sense of connection made, and just could sense what it may have been like.
Was that a welcome feeling or not?
It was a welcome feeling. I think a lot of that had to do with Miriam and Richard and their openness.
Yeah.
And they were very pleasant. They were very pleasant.
I want to know about the photograph.
We go about the grounds, and we come back into the house. And I'm flipping through a photo album.
Old photos, recent photos?
Old photos. Mm-hmm. I had already looked at some that they had sitting around, and so I'm flipping through this photo album, and bam, there's the photo. Here is my great-great-grandmother, appears to be sitting in a field.
Outside?
Outside.
Interesting.
You can see the field laid out behind her. She's seated in probably an old ladder-back chair. You can tell she's wearing somewhat tattered clothing. Her shoes are sort of awkward looking. They appear to be some type of boot that she's wearing. And I say, "Hey, is this my great-great-great-grandmother?" And she said, "Oh, yes. That is a picture of Aunt Nursie holding my sister."
Aunt Nursie?
Aunt Nursie. And when she says that, it changes whatever was left within me as far as the tension, if there was any.
Why?
Because when she refers to my great-great-great-grandmother as aunt, it gives me the sense that to her she is a person. She's a human being. She wasn't property. She wasn't chattel. She was someone that they respected, someone that they loved to some degree. And as she continued to talk about my grandmother, she continued to refer to her as Aunt Nursie. She always referred to her as Aunt Nursie. I was like, wow, that's amazing.
How old is your great-great-grandmother in this photo?
She is approximately 90 years old.
Wow.
In this photo. Because she dies in 1941, according to her death certificate, and she was 98 at the time of her death, and this photograph was taken around 1933.
What do you see in her face?
Ooh, there are many years of labor. I can see her hands, and her hands are When I think of ladies' hands today, I see something feminine. I see something soft. I see something that is not so bruised up. But when I look at her hands as they are wrapped around this small child, they're large. They look hard. They look rough. And her face is, she's a very dark woman, which you can tell she's been in the sun for many, many days. And but yet I see that authority that she must have had on the plantation. I can tell that she was probably a matriarch of some sorts.
Is there any emotion in her face?
There is, and it would be somewhat difficult to identify all of the emotions that are in her face. On one hand, you can see the care that she has towards this small child. On the other hand, you can see the appreciation that she has for being photographed. You know, that they care enough about her that...
That was an honor of sorts.
Exactly. And you can also see that she is tired. She's very tired. You can tell that she has worked many years and she's tired. So you can see that in her face.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone, away from home. Sometimes I feel like a
That's the voice of Mary D. Williams. She'll be a guest on an upcoming edition of The Story, and she'll be here talking about keeping the old gospel music, the spirituals, alive. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When we left Craig James, he was sitting in what was once the plantation home with Miriam James, and they're looking at the photo of Craig's great-great-great-grandmother, Nursie. In the photo, she's holding Miriam's sister, Jenny, when Jenny was just a baby, and Craig asked Miriam what she remembers of the woman she called Aunt Nursie.
She remembers Aunt Nursie being in the house every single day. She remembers Aunt Nursie being in charge, giving orders, and making sure things were done and done right. She remembers her being a very gentle woman. She remembers her being yet strong, a very strong woman. And she remembers her being the person that everyone respect it.
So seeing this one photograph actually had a fairly significant effect on you.
Very significant. When I saw that photograph of my ancestor and she's sitting there, and then imagining the institution of slavery that she had endured, even though she was approximately 90 years old, and even though I could see that she was somewhat tired, I could also see a very proud woman. And what that said to me is, I come from good stock, and that I should be a very proud man.
Something else happened as well. Craig James says he was sitting there with Miriam James. Now, he's African American, she's white. Yet because slaves often took the last name of their owners, today, these two share the same last name, and they share a piece of history.
It gave me a sense of who their ancestors were. And based upon that, it appeared that their ancestors were good people, people who treated my ancestors very well. I saw them as friend.
It's interesting what you're saying, though, because, you know, the storybook version of this part of imagining is that those were the people that owned your people, and that there's a natural antagonism that would come from that, or if not antagonism, some kind of distance or antipathy.
Yes.
But the photograph which links your families, you're saying it in some way draws you closer together.
It does. Even though it was common to see mammies and nannies holding the slave owner's babies, but when I see my ancestor holding their ancestor, and when I have this opportunity to speak to them face to face, we're both distant ancestors to what has happened in the past. And knowing that I carry their name to some extent, that draws us more together as well. It wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Craig James says he recently found out something new about the family, and here's what he wrote. After the Emancipation Proclamation, John James, that's the owner, informed his 100 slaves that he was no longer their master. He told them they were all free, and whatever they chose to do, leave or stay, he would continue to assist them any way he could. There was a meeting among the elder slaves, and the choice was made to stay, at least until all the harvesting was complete. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As we know from the photograph, Nursie stayed on the plantation for the rest of her life. Craig James imagines that Nursie's probably buried somewhere on the land there, but he doesn't know where. For now, Nursie's photograph at the plantation remains his only connection to that part of his family's past.
Miriam still has the original picture.
In that album?
In that
on
album.
On the plantation?
And of course, I requested the photograph. And she responded that she would have to sit down with other family members, and they would have to decide whether or not they could release the photograph. And her comment was, because I would hate for this photograph to be lost. And I said to her, Miriam, trust me. If I had possession of that photograph, it would not be lost. It would be my most cherished photograph of all the photographs that I currently own. And we kind of smiled and moved on to something.
We'll leave it for the time being and revisit it.
Yeah.
It's interesting in a way because I suspect, although this woman, Grandma Nursie or Aunt Nursie, is your blood relative, that she sees a direct family relation as well.
I think so.
Which says something about your great-great-grandmother, that she had that kind of influence over not just the slaves but the slave owners.
Absolutely. In the book, it tells a story that a few months before she passed, she says to Gibson James, who is now owner of the plantation, I need a new dress to be buried in, and I need some cloth for a dress to be made. And he immediately goes out and finds the best white cloth that he can find and has a dress made. And she does not wear it. She's buried in it. She kept it unused until her death.
Tell me something else. You started collecting photographs of African Americans taken in the last years of slavery some time ago. This collecting led you almost by chance to a photograph of your great-great-great-grandmother. Knowing that that exists, do the other photographs still matter?
They do. They still have significant value to me, and they are still important to me.
Do they have a voice? Do they have meaning as well?
They do. As I sit and I look at these photographs and I study them and I study the people that are contained within these photographs, they continue to tell me, go forth and do your very best, regardless of what your circumstances are. So these photographs, yes, they're still significant.
And if that photograph of Aunt Nursie, your great-great-great-grandmother, could speak to you, what would it say?
It would say to me, you are great because you come from me and because I did the best with the circumstances that I had. and that I loved in spite of. I took the circumstances that were handed to me, and I did a great job with them. You know, that's what it would say to me. It would encourage me to be the very best that I can be.
Craig James will make his second visit to the old James Plantation, now known as Sycamore Springs, this coming weekend. This time, Miriam's sister, Jenny, will also be there. She's the baby pictured in the arms of Craig's great-great-great-grandmother, Nursey. We'll stay in touch with them. We'll let you know how it turns out. And if you're interested, we have a number of those photos on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Megan Griswold has taken a rather unorthodox approach to family planning. She's 39. She'll turn 40 this year. She was once married, but things didn't work out. No kids. She's now single. A few years ago, Megan decided to freeze some of her eggs. She's one of a growing number of women who are doing this as a way to preserve some of her healthier eggs for a time when she might need them. She's since done it several more times.
It began with an arrival of a large FedEx box filled with drugs and a Sharps container. And so you're doing a small injection every day into your belly and noticing some changes in terms of the hormones. But I was expecting radical, crazy hormonal roller coaster ride. And in my case, it just didn't play out that way, which surprised me because I was really prepared for that.
And what were you thinking first time around? Why'd you do it initially?
Well, it was Christmas time, and I was thinking about the year that I'd had and the year to come and, you know, actually asking myself what I wanted in my life, you know. And it was one of those holidays where I actually had gotten to stay home and think about those things as opposed to being in a mad rush from relative event to relative event. And I was actually sitting in the bathtub thinking about what was important to me, and at the top of that list was having kids, and I wasn't in a position to do so at the time. And so I literally almost, you know, finished sort of jumped out of the bath and decided I'd start looking into it, oddly. And I had read some time ago, so a seed had been planted a ways back before that about women who were starting to freeze their eggs, and there was an article about extend fertility, and that's where it started.
Megan has a lot of faith in the process. She says she's a nurturer by nature, and she's nurtured her eggs by talking to them.
But I told these particular eggs that were going that they needed to be prepared for some sort of adventure, you know. So I actually did talk to my eggs. Do you think that's weird?
Well, it depends on what else you told them.
Well, I told them that this was an unusual situation and that, because I thought, you know, you don't know what effect, you know, people talk to their babies in utero.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, you know, I'll talk to my eggs and told them that if they were interested in going on a big adventure, they would be taken out of me, and then they would be frozen. And if they were at some point thawed, that was meant that I was in a great relationship and ready to ask one of them to help make a baby. So they shouldn't come if they thought that that was sort of an odd thing to do.
I guess I want to know if you made any promises to your eggs.
About what? About, well, I think that was sort of a promise to say that I would, if I was actually going to ask to use them, that I would have be in a really healthy, committed, good relationship. You know, that's partly why I did it, because I felt like there's two separate issues. You know, there's the desire to parent, and then there's being in a healthy, committed partnership. And I think I didn't want to confuse those two things. Just because you might be biologically ready, you know, to have a baby doesn't mean you're in the situation that would be ideal to raise children. And I was, but you know, perhaps conservative about that and aware of that.
Why is the partner part of it so important to you, Megan?
Well, first of all, I know people who single parent, and I just don't think that that's easy. And I think there's just this deep-seated desire in me to create my own family unit. You know, I came from a family that was divorced, and, you know, I just wanted to be really sure.
Did you talk to your mother about this?
I did. Yeah. Around the time when I was deciding, she had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So I'd been thinking a lot about how little control we have over the way we enter the world and the way we leave it. And that was partly sort of what made me decide to go towards the things I thought were important and just sort of give it my best shot, but that there weren't any guarantees. You know, I think when you get a loved one diagnosed with something that will likely take their life, you know, you get to ask yourself those hard questions about why am I here and what really matters and how do I want to experience and express love in my life. She was supportive.
So how old was she when you were born?
She was 38.
Uh-huh.
So that's why when I got to 36, I was comfortable with the idea of being an older mother, but I had thought, you know, I don't want to be quite as old as my mother was. And so when I got to that age at 36, I thought, holy cow, here I am at that age and not in a relationship that's clearly the best choice would be to have kids. And I wasn't ready at the time to have it be this, it was after my husband, it was a boyfriend. And I wasn't at the time to have this be a sort of a deal breaker. I felt like I needed time to sort of figure out what was happening between us.
Have you set yourself any kind of a deadline, or have the doctors set you any kind of a deadline saying, look, all we know is that your eggs are likely to be healthy for, you know, X number of years, or you've said to yourself, okay, if I get to 45 and nothing's changed, then maybe I'll have them fertilized or maybe I'll just give up on it. How far out does the plan go?
Yeah, well, I've joked that I don't need to be some, like, extraordinarily, like, older mother on the cover of, like, you know, the National Enquirer at 85 or something. You know, I'm just trying to protect these middle range years. I think I'm imagining using them in my 40s if, you know, I have trouble naturally. You know, I don't think I would want to be in this sort of Tony Randall, Charlie Chaplin situation, you know, like just being, you know, barely able to pick up the baby, you know, sort of handing it over to somebody. You know, I that's not really one of my goals. But as for what they've said, you know, it seems like the technology for freezing, it's able to freeze longer than I would logically opt to explore.
Right, so that's not an issue.
Yeah.
Well, I have no authority on this except to say the 40s are good years, so.
Well, I'm liking 39 quite a bit, so.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Megan Griswold says that whether or not she ever uses those eggs, the experience of harvesting them and freezing them has changed her perspective on parenting.
You know, I had a sort of a deeper, conviction about how much I wanted to be a mother no matter how that looks, you know, whether I'm able to use these frozen eggs or not, you know, that's one way to parent, you know, whether I'm able to get pregnant naturally, you know, that's another way, whether I'll adopt, you know, it somehow affirmed my desire to be a parent and to embrace whatever way that might come. And sure, I would love to have a baby naturally, you know, I've been getting my period since I was 12 or whatever it is. So, you know, there's a part of me that's always wanted to, you know, take my womb out onto the open road and see what it can do, you know, but I'm more open about how parenting might look for me down the road. And you'd think it would maybe happen in the reverse, and maybe it does for some people, but you'd think, you know, this has to work, this absolutely, but for some reason it sort of loosened the grip of needing things to look a particular way.
Megan Griswold joined me from Colorado. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Megan reminded me of another woman I talked with some months back. You might also remember Sharon McNeil. Sharon and her husband Eric had only just been married when he was diagnosed with cancer. They were worried about the effect of the chemotherapy, so Sharon told me that they arranged to have some of his sperm frozen.
We had been given every hope at that time that things would turn out well.
Yeah.
I knew that chemotherapy can cause a man to be sterile, so I thought, you know, if things are going to work out well, we'd still like to have a family someday. We should think ahead and have some sperm put in the bank. It was actually a funny story to hear him tell of the actual experience of making the donation. But
are you going to tell me that one?
I can.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
Although it's certainly not as funny as when he used to tell it. And, you know, I have to say that throughout, he did keep his sense of humor. That was one of the good things about it. you know, what you would imagine is being sent in somewhere and, you know, they give you some things in this little private room or something. But when he went in, there was a student that handed him the specimen cup and told him where to go. And he thought he was going to get some little private room. And it ended up being in the office of this female director of the program. And they just shut the door behind him and he was there and her phone was ringing and her lunch was on her desk and... You know, there was nothing ceremonious about it.
Not a memorable occasion.
No, just get the job done, and that was that.
At the time, was he thinking, like you, that this was just a precaution, that it would be good to have some healthy sperm set aside? Or do you think that he was also thinking, boy, this may be a lot more serious than even we think?
I think that he was more tuned into the fact that perhaps things would not go well than the rest of us. I mean, I think he was hopeful, definitely, but he didn't verbalize it too much, but I think that he felt right away that this was not going to end well.
And how long from the time that you and Eric got the news did Eric live?
17 months.
Boy, that's so fast.
He was treated very successfully at first with a round of chemotherapy, and then was about to start radiation and head back to work when it sort of relapsed.
And in the last weeks that you guys were together, Sharon, did you ever talk about that sperm that he'd set aside?
We did have a conversation very close to the last couple of weeks of his life. And I don't even remember how it started, really. But I think I asked him how he would feel about it if I were to pursue that, having a baby after he was gone. And he, you know, gave every indication that if that's what I wanted to do, that would be great. You know, things are still blurry. When I'm looking back on that time, things were definitely blurry. I might not have felt blurry at the time, but yeah. Looking back now, they were. But I did think about it fairly soon after, and then off and on over the last 10 years.
It was about 10 years after Eric's death when Sharon McNeil made her withdrawal from the sperm bank. Soon enough, she was pregnant with twins.
Yes. Yeah, first time was the charm. I was at school and got the call that everything was looking good so far. And then after that, it's a week-by-week visit. Because you know that two went in, so I knew that at least started out as twins. So then it was just the fact that, wow, they're... really still are two of them.
What, it's a boy and a girl?
A boy and a girl, yes. It'll be a lot of work, obviously, but I think it's also going to be great that they'll always have a playmate and have a friend right at home.
Is Eric in any way still a part of this? I mean, do you ever talk to him?
It's almost like he's a part of me, so what I know, he knows.
Right.
I mean, I always just assume that he's around and he knows what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if, you know, people have theories of, oh, this was meant to be, or this is, you know, I'm not sure how much control the people who have already passed before us have over what goes on down here, but I certainly think that he's aware of it and probably very happy.
And that's where we left it last November. But I wanted to check back in with Sharon McNeil, and she's delighted to report that the twins have arrived.
They were born on Valentine's Day.
Well, that's nice.
Appropriately enough, yes.
And everything went okay?
Yeah, I did have to have a C-section because they were both breech, but everything went very well, and they're both very healthy, and they were a good size. Audrey was 6 pounds, 1 ounce, and Charlie was 5'14". Yeah, so we're doing well.
You sound remarkably composed for a mother of twins that are just a month old.
It's a facade. I'm composed right now. At about 3 a.m, that's a different story. You know, the first week was a little bit rough. You know, over the next couple of weeks, I'll be doing more of it on my own. Different story, but I think it'll be okay.
And is it too early to ask if there's any family resemblance on either side?
I see a little bit of both. I think that Charlie looks a little bit more like me, and perhaps Audrey looks a little bit more like Eric, but it's so hard to tell it at this age.
And I wonder if in one of your sleep-deprived moments you've had a moment to sort of look up, talk to Eric, let him know what's going on.
So I think he's been in this from the start, so I think he's well aware, and I'm sure he's thrilled. You know, I had some doubts leading in the weeks leading up to their delivery, but that all went away very quickly when they got here.
So here we are at the one-month point. Are you dreading the time when the sisters and the brothers-in-law and the parents all get back to their own affairs and they leave you with the twins?
Yes, I am, actually. But I know it's been dwindling a little bit, you know, here and there, the amount of help. And the more responsibility that's on me is a little foreboding. But I think we can handle it. They're very good babies. You know, it's just the fact when they both need something at the same time. That's, you know, and the fact that, you know, if they're up at different times, then I'm up all night. But they're generally just a joy to have around.
Well, if it's any comfort to you, one of my close friends has twins that are now past their first birthday, and they are easy to care for and an absolute delight.
Oh, that's good to hear. I keep hearing that the first few months are definitely the roughest, and that after that it tends to get progressively easier. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll be looking forward to when they sleep through the night.
Sharon McNeil joined me from her home in upstate New York. We talked while the twins were napping. Funny thing, she didn't have the time to make it into a studio to talk to me. I'm not really sure about that. In case you were wondering, her son Charlie's middle name is Eric. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. A bit of news this week from Columbia, South Carolina. I don't know if you remember that adorable beagle, Uno, the one that won Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club last month. Well, Uno, it's been announced, is retiring. His story, his win, prompted a fun letter from Alice Palmer in Chicago. She wrote me to say that in light of that beagle winning Best in Show, I couldn't help but be reminded of a beagle that we once owned, named Herman. So Alice and I had a little chat about Herman.
We were having a dinner party, and I put the roast on a slow oven to cook while I went out, knowing that when I got back, I could finish it up, and that would be it. I got home, and nothing was amiss. I looked around. I opened the oven door. No roast, no pan, no nothing. There was nothing to tell me there was a problem.
Well, what did you think it was? Did you think someone had broken into your house?
I thought, well, did somebody come in the house? I was standing there just stunned. So then I heard these little scratchy things. I was looking for Herman, saw him trying to get under couch or whatever it was, and you knew that he had eaten the roast. You know how beagles are made. The middle of him looked like the roast. He had eaten the entire thing, and he had hidden the pan under the stove so that nothing was showing.
However did a dog the size of a beagle open an oven door? I don't get that.
Well, it was a pull-down door.
But they're all pulled-down. Most of them are pull-down doors.
Yes, well, he jumped up, put his little paws around it, and pulled it down.
And then he pulled the hot pan out of the oven.
I guess so. And I was gone long enough that he could have left it out of the oven a few minutes just to let, you know, the worst of the heat cool off a bit before he ate the entire thing.
And there was no sign of any of the
None.
Drippings or anything in the kitchen?
Nothing. Nothing. The pan, once we found it under the stove, you could see it had been licked clean.
How big was this roast, Alice?
It was about a 4 or 5 pound.
That's half the size of a beagle, right?
Yes, that's the size of a beagle, the middle part of a beagle.
And Herman ate the whole thing.
Ate the whole thing.
And what did you have for dinner that night?
You know, I don't even remember, but it was whatever.
Cheese
it
sandwiches
was.
Or something.
Probably, yeah. Whatever was it left over in the refrigerator.
Alice Palmer lives in Chicago. The story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowwood. Rachel McCarthy and Jen Nathan work as our audio editors. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. Our intern this week, Greg Barbera. The story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of the story, Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.